Welcome, everybody. We have a special program for you. Whether you're an employee or employer, you're definitely going to want to listen in today's program because there's been a lot of things that have been changing, and it's really important as either an employer or employee, you want to know how that's going to affect you. And really, since COVID, a lot of things have been looked at a lot differently. And I know with people working remotely, some people are hybrid, some people are working in the office. There's going to be things you're going to want to know. And so we have Lori Goldstein that has joined us. And Lori is an attorney that represents both employers and employees in work-related areas. And she's been honored with several awards, including Super Lawyers of Illinois, Super Lawyers Illinois 100 Top Lawyers, and Super Lawyers Illinois Top 50 Women Lawyers, and rated superb by AVVO and distinguished by Martindale and Hubbell. So she knows her stuff is the moral of the story. And while she's based in Illinois, she represents clients all over the United States. So you want to listen in. And Lori, it's so glad to have you back. I know you had a very interesting program, and time flies. I think it's been a few years already since we had you on. But boy, I'm really looking forward to today's visit because I do know a lot of things are changing in the world of employment rules.
Yes, they are. Thank you, Jim, for inviting me back. Time does fly. I figured it was last year and it was July of 2021. So there's been a lot of changes since then, for sure.
Well, one of the things that I've been hearing tossed around quite a bit, and I don't know how close it is to passing, and maybe some states have it already, but I think there's a federal law, or it might be state to state. I'm not quite clear on it, but to ban employee non-competes. So what's the latest? What does that mean? And what's kind of prompted that even?
So interesting that you said you weren't sure if it was federal or state to state, because currently non-competes are governed state to state. It depends on state law. There's no federal law that regulates them. But there is a proposal to have a federal ban. So that would, you know, supersede all of the state laws and replace whatever state laws we had and ban them completely or almost completely. This was prompted, I would say, by the current administration that has been more pro-employee in many ways and is, from the employee side, from unions that feel that there's too many restrictions on individuals in their ability to go to work where they want and work with clients, et cetera. So this is a proposed ban from the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC. The proposed rule came out January 5th of this year. And it would not only ban non-competes going forward, but retroactively as well. It would invalidate whatever existing non-competes there are. And then employers would be required to notify anybody that has signed those, even if they haven't been at the company for a year or two, that don't ignore that provision because we can't enforce it anymore.
So how does that work if the law, the way it's proposed, if that passes? You know, a lot of companies have their own secret sauce, so to speak, you know, trade practices, customer list, all that. So when we have these anti-disclosure agreements and all that, how's that going to impact that? Because a lot of that is, you know, you invest a lot of money into training an employee. If they can just walk out the door, is that going to leave businesses in a lurch, or is there still some protections in place for businesses?
Great question. And the business community's reaction, not surprisingly, to this proposed ban is very negative. They reject at least a broad ban, and they're pushing to narrow the scope so that it's not a complete ban on all non-competes. And the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has already vowed to fight the ban. So what the FTC has said, and a lot of people agree with, is there are still restrictions that an employer can have that wouldn't be affected by this. One is an NDA, non-disclosure agreement, or confidentiality provision that says this is the company's confidential information, or our client's confidential information. This is ours. You can't take it. You can't use it other than for work here. You can't disclose it to others. That won't be affected. There's also intellectual property type of restrictions that would still be enforceable, as well as non-solicit. So different from a non-compete, which means you can't go to work for certain places or in this industry, et cetera. A non-solicit is you can't go after certain customers or our customers for a certain period, and or you can't go after our employees or our contractors to try to hire them away. Those will still be valid. So it's just the non-compete portion. So, there's still restrictions that could be used, but I can't imagine that there's going to be a total ban because I work on both sides, employers and employees, and I definitely see the employee side, but an employer is going to need these restrictions and probably non-competes in certain situations. High-level executives who have access to, information and clients, et cetera, there's going to have to be some give and take, I think.
So it's going to be interesting if how that's going to apply, and I know probably a good thing about it is now we have a universal law. I look at all these employers that now with remote workers. I know we have half of our workers are in a different state than we are. We even have had three workers outside the country. So in that circumstance, things like non-compete and things like that, if a company is domiciled in a certain state, does that mean it's going to be enforceable in the other states, or would you have agreements that are based on the state that the employee is in or where the employer is?
It should be where the employee is working. That really is the nexus. That's the connection the employee has, is the state where they're working. But a lot of agreements, contracts have the domicile or headquarters of the company where the employee has no connection to. And that's called a choice of law provision. So the parties agree it's going to be Delaware law. However, depending on where the agreement is being enforced or somebody's seeking to enforce it, which could be where the employee, was working or living, where the employee has moved to work for a competitor. It depends where they're, whatever court they go into, a court won't necessarily just accept the party's choice of law automatically. If there's a law, if there's a state with a connection to the employee that's more favorable to employees based on that law, a court will probably enforce that law. But we don't know. So every time I get a call from an individual, I have to tell them it depends, if they try to enforce it, where they try to enforce it, what that court wants to do. I can tell you what the laws are in these different places, but I'm not sure which ones will apply. So it's this would reduce that iffiness, then you would at least know nobody can enforce this non-compete.
Well, I would think too, we've heard in certain sectors there's been quite a bit of layoffs. So for those employees, this is probably good news because they might have some opportunities that they didn't have before.
Exactly. And there's been, I mean, since the pandemic and the great resignation, there's been a lot more movement. There have been a lot of people who've started their own businesses, and many of them, have either just ignored their non-competes or hoped that nobody would bother them. And some get bothered. Some companies really enforce those, and others don't. So, again, if you're in a state like Illinois that has very employee protective laws, including if the company tries to enforce it and they lose, they pay the employees' attorney's fees. That's a big disincentive for a company to go after somebody.
Well, it's important that whoever's listening, whether you're an employer or employee, that you know what your rights are. And because one thing I don't think anybody really wants to get into, and I know you make your living doing it, but there's really no winners in litigation, is there?
That's true. Well, the winners are the law firms and the lawyers who, continue to get paid the fees to fight the fight. But no, it's so much better to settle for so many reasons.
Yeah, and I think too, so many people sign these agreements, they don't know what it really means. They don't take the time to understand what they're signing. And then all of a sudden there's this problem down the road. And that can be an expensive way to learn what those documents really mean. So it's important to understand what you're doing and what you're signing. And so for example, in your practice, if an employee's presented something to sign, or an employer's looking to put some things in place, it certainly would be good to talk to an attorney and at least get a idea of what your rights are and what you're doing by signing those papers.
Definitely, because I mean, on the employer side, if you put together an agreement that isn't valid because it doesn't comply with applicable law, what good is it? So you want an attorney to at least make sure it's compliant. And on the employee side, some employees walk away from those because they would rather either not take severance pay or not take that job if it's going to mean, a 1 or 2 year non-compete afterwards. So really know what you're going to sign and get some legal advice. It's so much better than getting into litigation.
All right, so let's switch gears a little bit. We've talked about the pandemic, and I know the workplace has really changed dramatically. I know during the pandemic, a lot of people were put out of work if they were non-essential employees, and then we started to open up again. But a lot of the employers were having people work remotely. And now, as we've come back out of the tail end of this thing, a lot of employers have missed having their workers in the office. So what kind of things have happened? Because, I know one thing that might be an issue if an employer's asking someone to come back to the office and that employee doesn't want to come back, is that creating some issues as far as, hey, you know what, you don't want to come back, we're firing you or whatever. How does that impact both employer and employee if we're changing back to working back in the office again?
Right, which comes down to, what rights do we have and what obligations do we have? And before I get into that, I just wanted to wrap up on the non-compete that the FTC is reviewing public comments on this proposed ban. They are going to vote on this in April of 2024. So we will know by then if it's going to come to pass. So it's around the corner.
All right.
So, I've seen, and from my experience and my clients, it's the whole gamut of some companies have been fine continuing remotely and they're giving up all their office space and everybody's doing great to everybody wants, they want everybody back in the office full time, which I'm not finding that very much. It's more of the hybrid. We'd like people to be here 3 days a week or everybody be here Tuesday and Thursday. And even when they have these rules, I'm finding that not everybody's following them and the companies are not pushing them that hard yet. So I'm not sure what will happen as time goes on. But Labor Day this year marked the last day of full-time work from home for over 1 million employees in the US. And in terms of requiring people to return to the office at least part of the week, big companies like FedEx, Lyft, even Zoom, have asked their employees to come in. But there's others who have remained remote with no plans to change that, and a lot have settled into the hybrid phase. So we know from WFH Research, a survey in 2023, that 25% of Americans are now working from home. And then we know what the vacancy rates are in the offices. We've heard that it's still hard to pull off return to the office. People are so used to this, different way to work, which seems to be, very efficient in most cases. I think that the concerns that we have to balance are integrating new hires into the workplace, into the culture, the loss of, physical one-on-one collaboration and socialization. And on the other hand, in this economy, it's been difficult to recruit and attain and retain talent, and you have to be competitive with benefits and compensation, and that also includes work-life balance, flexibility. Are you going to support my mental health? Are we going to be able to work from home and be okay with that? So we know that from a couple studies on the effects of work from home on productivity, and the results are all over the board, ranging from big drops in productivity by as much as 19%, according to the Becker Institute for Economics at the University of Chicago in 2021. And then fast forward to 2023, now an improvement in productivity by 24%. That's by Barrero, Bloom, and Davis. And the experts tell us that it depends on how work from home is managed. If you have good management, good incentives, some required face time, employees will probably be more productive and more appreciative.
That's interesting. I know, now I just had a client recently was working for a company and most of the work he did remotely. Then he was relocating to another state, out of state from where his employer was located, and they said, "We're not going to allow you to do that unless you sign a new contract, and we're going to cut your pay," and they were going to do all this, and he finally decided, "Well, the heck with this, I'm out of here," and he went to work for somebody else. So it's interesting to see how different companies are taking it, because I think they were trying to transition more people to coming in, and the fact that that would have been an impossibility where he was moving to, had them draw a hard line in the sand.
Right. And I've seen examples of companies taking a different perspective on employees who are remote versus not remote. Even if they agree to let the employee be remote, there's, pushback and perception is just, you're not in the office. And so when we have these meetings, you're not right here. We've got all these boards up and, ideas flowing back and forth and walking into people's offices. And so, and I think people miss out on assignments and things like that when they're not there. So they don't know what they're missing.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I know for us, I mean, we live in a small community and we have been struggling to find employees. And what's interesting is since we've put in the ads that we allow the flexibility of remote, even 100% remote, and then I don't know if someone just flicked a switch because I've talked to other business owners and they said it seems like in the last 4 to 6 weeks, all of a sudden, there's decent applicants applying again. Whereas prior to that, it usually was a lot of employees that couldn't hold a job anywhere, weren't really interested in working. And that was kind of the pool of workers we were seeing applying. And but now we're starting to see some quality ones. So it really is a delicate balance. I know I would absolutely, in a perfect world, prefer everybody to be here for the reasons that you mentioned. But if I have to choose between, not having any help or having help remote, because we've got some really good workers that know how to manage their time well and with Zoom meetings and everything else, I will tell you, if it wasn't for COVID, I would have never even considered it. And Zoom meetings were something. I mean, I set up the technology in my office to do all this with the idea that someone else will be using it. It's not going to be me. And with clients getting comfortable with Zoom meetings and everybody just kind of this becomes an everyday thing, it really has opened up the door to possibilities that can be a win-win for both employees and employers to have those as options.
Exactly. You just have to keep thinking about, balance and everybody's perspective and trying to do things that are, it's a settlement, it's a negotiation. It may not be everything either side wants, but come up with a system that works. And if it doesn't work, then change it, improve it. Or if somebody can't work outside the office, then you have to force them to come back in or find another job. But I'm glad to hear there's quality applicants. I've seen so much increase in reductions in force now and terminations and of quality people, that those are probably the people that you're starting to see apply. So I hope they get hired again.
Well, let's take a short break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about what's happening with the Department of Labor and overtime rules and things like that. So please stay tuned.
This is the Long-Term Care Minute. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, of the 16 million veterans who served during World War II, less than 558,000 are still alive. To make things worse, many of them now need long-term care. With the average cost of nursing home care approaching $7,000 monthly, we wondered, what should veterans do? For some advice on this, we called on long-term care expert and best-selling author Don Quante. So Don, what should our veterans do?
Well, quite simply, we recommend our veterans get a free copy of my book, Tax-Free Money for Long-Term Care, where they will learn about a little-known veterans benefit that may allow them to receive up to $26,000 a year tax-free to pay for long-term care. Give me a call right now. The next 30 listeners will get a free copy of my book.
That sounds great, Don. Just call 800-256-1607. That's 800-256-1607. This has been the Long-Term Care Minute.
Welcome back as we continue to visit with attorney Lori Goldstein, who has her own independent private practice in Illinois. She represents both employers and employees nationwide. And Lori, if someone has a problem with an employee or an employee is having a problem with their employer and they're looking to get some help, how do they get a hold of you?
Sure, Jim. They can reach me in a couple different ways. My email address is lori.a.goldstein@gmail.com. Phone number 847-624-6640. And I have a website that you can take a look at, and would be happy to talk to anybody about your issues, questions, concerns.
And I would say when choosing a lawyer, it's good for somebody that understands both sides of the issue and can help a resolution happen a lot quicker. You know, I see a lot of these attorneys where, you know what, if you're an employee and we're just going to sue every employer possible for all the money in the world, and then the ones that take the other stance and we're going to squash those employees at all costs, it's good to have someone that understands both sides and put things in proper perspective. You know, nobody wins a war, but you certainly need to know what your rights are and be prepared to, you know, have the dialogue, have the discussion, and come up with a resolution that can be win-win if at all possible. So we talked a little bit before the break about what's happening, the dynamics of this non-compete thing that's happening, and with you know, the hybrid employees, the total virtual, the total you know, be at the workplace, and how that dynamic keeps shifting. Well, we have another thing that is the Department of Labor has a pending recommendation to increase the minimum salary for overtime exemption. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure, Jim. So there are legal requirements for an employer to classify an employee as exempt, which means they would not be entitled to overtime pay for working excess hours, which is more than, well, under federal law, more than 40 hours per week. And a lot of employers get confused that they think salaried equals exempt. So as long as somebody's hourly, they get an overtime. But if I make somebody salaried, they don't. That's not true. You have to be salaried plus meet one of the exemption tests under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that's for another time. But there's also a minimum salary requirement in order for somebody to be declared as exempt. Currently, it's annually $35,568 or $684 per week. Many people have felt that for a long time that that's low and unrealistic, and, you know, it's very low compared to the salaries that we see now. It was just over $23,000 not that long ago. In 2016, there was a push to increase it from $23,000 to $47,500, so more than double. And it was a rule that was finally invalidated by a federal judge. eventually there was a compromise, and on January 1st of 2020, they raised it to the current 35,000 plus. So now, once again, the Department of Labor is seeking to increase it to $55,068, which would be $1,059 per week. There's what we call the highly compensated employee exemption. Currently, if somebody's earning at least $107,000 and change, they don't get overtime. This exemption would then rise to about $144,000. So the change would add 3.6 million more workers to the list of people who are considered non-exempt and would get overtime pay. And this statute would also be different than the other ones because it would automatically update the minimum salary threshold every 3 years to keep pace with changes in inflation, et cetera. So like the prior rule, the Department of Labor puts this out. They accept public comments on the proposal for 60 days. Actually, they're supposed to be, this is following their official publication. So they will officially publish this rule on October 30th. Then you have 60 days to comment. So you can imagine, you know, how the employee perspective of this and how employers see this as, you know, it will be very expensive for some employers who, you know, keep people just under that amount so that they don't, so that they're, keep them just above that amount so they don't get overtime. And now to keep them above is going to be a lot more. It would be 20,000 more than it is now. So.
Oh, so I see that as being really problematic, especially for small businesses from the standpoint of budgeting concerns. And, you know, and a lot of small businesses are very cyclical where they're, you know, slow at certain times of year, really busy in other times of the year. And I know, you know, for us, we have a lot of clients in that boat, and that's why they pay salaries so they can kind of budget it. So if all of a sudden they're getting all this overtime for a few months and then there's barely enough work to keep them busy, that's really going to cause the employers to, you know, really rethink things. And I would think something like that might even close some doors of opportunity, especially for people just getting into an entry-level position.
Right, that's true. It could change that. It could probably cause employers to have to hire more employees, you know, to get the work done. Because if you can only keep people to 40 hours, you'll need that many more people to get the work done. But it's so hard to attract and hire employees now. So with such a low workforce as it is and people already working, you hear about it all the time, just overloaded with after there's downsizing and consolidation, and then a person's suddenly doing the work of two, and then they're doing the work of three people. It could be cost prohibitive to some companies.
And what about, you know, what consideration is given? I know a lot of companies, you know, what they do is they've got these base salaries, and then they incentivize their employees with bonuses. You know, I got to believe a lot of those bonuses might end up getting taken away because you certainly won't get credit for that. You know, right. So I think sometimes they pass these rules without thinking them all the way through. And I think it could have some serious consequences, especially, you know, in those small or cyclical businesses. I think it might make things a lot more challenging, you know, in that area. And I think, too, you know, if they got to hire more employees, you know, those that are hardworking, that are, you know, in that boat, well, now they're not going to have extra hours. They're going to have other people getting the money because it'll be cheaper to hire somebody else than have to pay overtime to somebody that's there. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out. You know, I'm all for people getting paid well, and I'm all for also being a small business owner myself. I know that would, you know, we put a lot of people at salary, and we put them at salaries based on, you know, what, you know, with the idea that there's going to be certain times where they're working extra, But our goal is that they're in and out of here 8 hours a day. They have a good work-life balance. And but that would be problematic for us, because now we'd really have to start managing whether they're getting overtime or not, because we can't budget for that. We have some stuff that's cyclical as well. So that I'm interested to see what happens there. Now another thing is, what is pay transparency, and do we have to worry about that?
So that's a good segue. Pay transparency is basically being transparent with candidates and employees about what your company's pay scale is and what the benefits are. And so we have a growing number of states that require it. So again, check your applicable state law, but they mandate employers and recruiters to disclose the pay scale and the benefits in the job postings, so that the candidates, you know, there's no secrets. The laws are part of equal pay statutes, and the goal is to reduce discrimination and eliminate pay disparity that has been perpetuated, because when somebody asks you what salary you're making, and you know, you give them you tell them your salary, and it stays low because you just can't move up. So it levels the playing field by giving candidates and employees more information, more leverage in when they talk about compensation.
One question I have is, we're talking about all these things. I know sometimes there's exemptions for small employers with, say, less than 50 employees. Are these rules that we all talked about, is that all businesses that have an employee, or is it only at a certain size?
So we're talking, I mean, for pay transparency, I believe that this is all businesses. I think there are some statutes that require employers to provide information to the state, you know, Human Rights Commission, to so that the states can take a look at what they're paying, and see that there's equality, and, you know, and let them know if there's issues with disparity. I think the requirements to disclose all that are based on bigger companies, and I think usually 50 or more employees. But, you know, a lot of companies, you know, there's already a ban in most states, or many states, on asking candidates or their former employers about their salary history, or forcing them to give that information up. So those really don't matter I don't think company size matters there. I think that the whole idea is to try and reduce, you know, the perpetuated prior keeping people down.
And what about I would assume the non-compete is every company regardless of size. What about the overtime for salaried employees? Is that segmented by size of company, or is that also across the board?
Pretty much. Well, so the Fair Labor Standards Act covers companies that have interstate business, which is most companies. And then most states have a similar state statute that requires overtime and minimum wage. So although, you know, the state minimum salary may differ than the federal, sometimes it may be better for the employee. But in most cases, the states follow what states do. So, you know, that is something to check, both your state and check, you know, see what they do on the Department of Labor on the federal matter.
So one thing I look at in that transparency stuff, you know, typically I know we've always paid, you know, we started disclosing the salaries on our ads just because, you know, we wanted to make sure we're getting the right candidates, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, and I've seen ads like this all the time, and you know, pay is based on experience and you know, your background or whatever. So that's going to make it tougher to do stuff like that. So if anybody, or can you take years of experience as a consideration for what they're getting paid, or years of experience at the company? But one thing I look at is, you know, some employees are really good and some aren't so good. Does that mean they all have to get paid the same regardless of what job they're doing?
No, not at all. And I think the pay transparency, typically an employer would give a range. You can have a range for a position, and then that's where you can differentiate based on, you know, tenure and experience and performance. And I think, you know, probably it's just, we want to make sure that candidates and employees know that, you know, these are our salaries, and so that they know, you know, where they stand in the company, where they might stand if they want to go to a company. And I think that, you know, I think that'll be important for everybody, just to have that, that honesty. So there's, you know, it cuts out a lot of the questioning and not knowing, you know, if you're being too greedy, if you ask for too much, and not knowing whether you should even apply for a position because it's out of your range. So I think it's, you know, it's better for that purpose also, that it may cut through and make it easier to negotiate. And I think it's a base. So if an employee negotiates higher than that, you know, that happens all the time. If they have a better attorney negotiating, or if, you know, they get promoted, or they're better at their job than others, and you use, you know, non-discriminatory evaluation factors, of course you can differentiate.
So I want to wrap up with just, so we got all these potential rule changes, and is the only consequence to an employer the threat of lawsuits, or are there other penalties that could impact them as well?
Well, I mean, even short of a lawsuit, because all of these government agencies are involved, an employee can simply make a complaint to the Department of Labor, federal or state, and then a company's going to be investigated and could be audited, and then there may be fines and penalties to the governmental agency, even apart from claims by employees. There could be, and it's just, I mean, this is something that should be preventive, obviously, is to make sure that you have what you need in place, that you're properly classifying employees, so that you don't even have to go through the time and effort and expense of an investigation. And even if at the end of the investigation, they find that you're fine, you know, if you're clean and your employees are pretty much happy, most of the time you won't get a complaint. With non-competes, you know, everybody should be looking at their agreements, making sure on the employer side that it's they're currently valid and enforceable. Otherwise, they're not worth the paper they're written on. And employees need to know before they leave a place, or when they're leaving somewhere, you know, what can or can't they do going forward, and make sure that if there's an opportunity to negotiate that with their current employer, to do that. So there are a lot of ways to head off any kind of litigation.
Well, Lori, this has been great. I've learned a lot today, and I am hopeful we can have you on again soon as this stuff evolves and, you know, where the dust settles with all this. I think the moral of the story is, you know, be naive. Don't stick your head in the sand. Know where you stand, know what your rights are, and know what best practices are. And, you know, whether an employee or employer, always the best option is always having open communication. If there's problems, you know, you want to talk about that. Anytime people start lining up attorneys, it's never, never pretty. So, you know, having attorneys represent you in the beginning, so everybody's clear on where everybody stands, that's always a good thing. So one more time, Lori, if somebody would like your help and get your advice, how do they get a hold of you again?
Sure, Jim. My phone number is 847-624-6640. And my email address is lori.a.goldstein@gmail.com.
Well, Lori, thanks again for joining us, and I look forward to having you back on again real soon.
Thank you, Jim. This is all, as always, this was a great conversation, and you have great questions and information, so I learned from you too.
All right. Well, thank you, Lori. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
Thanks for joining us, and tune in again as we explore another phase of the real wealth process. And remember, if anything you heard in today's show you'd like to get more information about, contact your Real Wealth advisor. Also, if you feel that any of this information will be helpful to a friend or family member, just click the Forward to a Friend button.
The views expressed are not necessarily the opinion of the advisor or their broker-dealer and should not be construed directly or indirectly as an offer to buy or sell any securities mentioned herein. Individual circumstances vary. Investing is subject to risks, including loss of principal invested. No strategy can assure a profit against loss. Due to volatility within the markets mentioned, opinions are subject to change without notice. Information is based on sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy or completeness cannot be guaranteed. Any products mentioned in this program are not endorsed by Real Wealth or any associated partners. Products mentioned herein may contain their own risks. The views and opinions expressed in no way represent the opinion of the broker-dealer and have not been reviewed by the broker-dealer.
A registered representative does not offer legal or tax advice, and listeners are encouraged to discuss their financial needs with the appropriate professional regarding their individual circumstances.